Today on a special Rambling About Cars, we have 64 years of Honda history to go through. We're going to get to that right away. There's also four decades of Land Cruiser, third generation Porsche Panamera, a transparent engine, and an honest to goodness Tesla Cybertruck. Apparently it exists. We're going to get to all that, but first, let's roll. It's podcast time. I am Christopher Smith, Mr. Chris Bruce across the way. Please, please introduce our special guest that's going to take us through all of this wonderful Honda history.
Absolutely. We have Carl Poli, and he is from the American Honda Collection Hall in Torrance, California, which opened, what, just about in September, if I'm not mistaken. And he's going to be with us for about the first half hour of the show for a segment. So I'm saying that right now for you folks. I know usually we talk about cars and we get, you know, we kind of
we ramble
things, but exactly, we ramble. But Carl, he's only got 30 minutes with us. And so if you have any questions about Honda Museum in Torrance, California, please let us know. But we have plenty of questions for him as well. So I hope we answer them all for you. And so we're going to get this show started right now. So Carl, please tell us a little bit about the Honda Collection Hall in Torrance, California, if you could, please.
Yeah, no, absolutely. So interestingly, we moved to our current facility, which is 101 acres in Torrance, California. So it's our national headquarters for American Honda, which is the distributor and sales unit of Honda's presence in the US. We also have Honda Development and Manufacturing, which encompasses all of our manufacturing footprint in the US. But anyway, so American Honda moved into this Torrance campus in 1990. And obviously that was right in slap dab in the middle of like the beginning of the tuner craze that, you know, particularly that started with, you know, Honda Civics, obviously, you know, reliable, durable, over-engineered, overbuilt vehicles that people can just tune to the hilt and have a lot of fun with. And even though Honda has always been a very progressive company in that we're always looking forward, figuring out what new value we can provide to the customer. So we're always looking about our new things. But by the year 2000, we realized that, boy, people are really into Honda and Acura products. Maybe we should really start to put aside some of these vintage products that people seem to be really interested in. So it was really just an initiative that came from some executives and some other people within the marketing organization. So we leased a warehouse building just a quarter mile down the road from our campus. Even though we have 101 acres, we're completely full with all the other things that we do. So we leased this warehouse building and started to put together a collection of vehicles. And a little bit of randomness on how they came together. Some were late pre-production units. So, you know, going through the manufacturing process before you get a vehicle certified to sell, you have to, you know, make sure that everything's going okay, the manufacturing process is okay. So we have these pre-production units that are completely production spec. They look and feel and touch and drive like a production vehicle, but they can never be sold. And ultimately they end up being crushed. So several of those ended up in the collection hall that were previously used for photo shoots, for marketing campaigns and brochures and things like that. Some of which were purchased from associates that had enjoyed the vehicle and then kind of asked if the collection hall wanted it. And then some we actually searched out for in the marketplace and just bought them. So, you know, obviously the ideal thing would have been, okay, the first one that comes off the production line, let's put that aside. And so I know probably some manufacturers were able to do that. But as I said, we're always looking forward. And so we had to go backwards and obtain some of the vehicles. So we currently have 79 vehicles in the collection.
Oh, wow.
Only less than half of those are currently on display. So, you know, COVID was an awful thing and it really kind of disrupted so many things. But, you know, from my little perspective from the American Honda Collection Hall, there was a little bit of a silver lining in that it prompted the decision to move the collection hall onto campus. So I was handed off. My primary role is managing media relations for the Western US. So that basically involves with, you know, coordinating with fine folks like you and other members of the media to get you in our cars, give you experiences, information. So then hopefully you write and say nice things about them. But the collection hall was handed off to me in the doldrums of COVID. It was really mothballed, nothing going on. And then I had a knock at the door and said, Carl, we need you to move out of the warehouse. We're giving up the lease. So I said, well, where are we going to go? He said, well, somewhere on campus. We've got 101 acres. I'm sure you can find some room. So literally, I went traipsing around the campus, you know, looked around the corner of the warehouse. We have a distribution center. You have any room? No, no, we're full. You know, we're all these parts all around the country. You know, I go over to our Studio 540 where we have a kind of film studio. You have any room? No, no, we don't. So basically, I went everywhere that I thought, said, we don't have a big, large space because obviously it's the national headquarters. It's mainly office buildings. So they said, well, where do you want it? And I said, well, you know what? The best place would be right in our lobby. Mm-hmm. So we had, I was given, myself and our facilities team were given a substantial budget, and we completely knocked out the eastern side of our first floor of our lobby, which used to be conference rooms, and we created a display area. So we have 20,000 square feet that includes our main lobby area, and the images that you're showing kind of eastern side, where we have a horseshoe space where anyone that comes into our headquarters can walk around. It's designed to be somewhat self-guided. We have a room that we call that one right there that we call the Pico room, because our first headquarters in the US was in Pico Boulevard in Los Angeles in 1959. And so we have a little room that the entryway is themed after the frontage of that building. Oh, we have a mural of it on one wall. And we have a very, very large screen where we have a narrated video of our history, which started in 1959. And we're still here and we're still going very strong. So I'm absolutely thrilled. This is really a dream opportunity for me to create something to showcase to fellow associates, to business partners, dealers, and especially to the enthusiasts that we love you, we love our products, please come and check it out. And even though I'd said that it's open during the week, because it's just, you know, our regular business hours, I wanted to create something special and really focus the public's attention to come and visit the collection hall. So I love going to Cars and Coffee events. I just love how informal it is. You don't have to register. You don't have to pay. You know, everyone's an enthusiast. You bring whatever you have that you feel other people might be interested in. Even if they're not, if you're interested in it, just bring it along. You'll probably find somebody else that thinks it's cool. So I love that idea. So I came up with the idea of a Cars, Bikes, and Coffee event. It's kind of like a tweener event between a Cars and Coffee and a full-blown show. So we had our first one on October the 21st. And so we had some enhancements to a regular Cars and Coffee. So people showed up, they brought their beautiful cars and motorcycles. We had a DJ spin and wax. He was playing vinyl. We had some food trucks. We had some vendors and we had some special displays. So I'd done my research and I'd spoken to others that organize Cars and Coffee and other ones that have kind of similar enhancements in that there's more than just a parking lot. You know, maybe there's something else for people to see. And so there's another manufacturer who has a kind of like a little kind of an owner's experience. It's not technically a track. It's a European luxury brand. And they have something similar, and they're just a couple of cities down the road from us in Carson. And they get, you know, 300 to 400 people on a given weekend. And then they had the maximum of 6, I think maybe pushing on 800. So that was where I was basing. So I had communicated with the media. We had a grand opening of the collection hall in September. We issued a press release. I reached out to all of my friends in the media. and reached out to social media. I know a lot of enthusiasts, a lot of vendors that do custom builds and provide other products for our products. And we ended up having 1,100 vehicles.
Wow.
2,500 people show up.
That's awesome.
I was called by the Torrance Police Department twice because we had a 2-mile line of traffic wrapping around our campus, and it caused a traffic alert in the city of Torrance. So, in fact, funny enough, this afternoon, I just got off a call with 10 members of the city of Torrance for me to explain myself and tell them how we're going to address this moving forward. So I have some really, really good plans to make ingress into the facility much, much easier, much quicker for attendees. But I mean, I was just absolutely thrilled with every person I spoke with. I had a huge beaming smile on their face. I mean, everyone just enjoyed the time. We had families come out, enthusiasts. We even had an enthusiast with an NSX that drove down from Portland, Oregon to make sure he was at the first Cars, Bikes, and Coffee. We had people come out from Phoenix. It was an absolutely thrilling event. We will be holding those every other month. So the next one is actually coming up in less than 3 weeks, in December the 16th. The next one will be on February the 17th. And then I've done some research and figured out that the third Saturday of the month is the date that has the least amount of competition with similar activities. But the third Saturday of April is April the 20th, and that is actually the weekend of the Acura Grand Prix of Long Beach.
Oh, so perfect. Coincidental timing.
I know, but I'm working with Honda Performance Development, whose name will change to Honda Racing Corporation US at the beginning of the year, because they're going to be kind of aligning with the rest of Honda's global racing activity. And HPD now, well, soon to be HRC.
Will
be involved with Formula One engine development. So I'm working with them to make the April 13th. So I'm going to shift my event by 1 week. So April the 13th will be a kickoff party for the week of the Acura Grand Prix of Long Beach. And we're planning to have current Indy cars, IMSA cars, drivers, and then try to get as many types of Honda racing present as possible, because Honda is involved with more types of racing than any other company. I mean, we have obviously our automobile side, right from Formula One to Indy to IMSA to touring car. But obviously we have our motorcycles as well. So we're involved globally with MotoGP, with World Superbike, obviously motocross and supercross, particularly in the US. In fact, this past season, we swept the motocross and supercross season, and we had those race-winning bikes on display for the first Cars, Bikes, and Coffee. And, you know, Honda engines power more go-karts than any other type of powertrain. We have our outboard motors. So, you know, we have race boats that are powered by Hondas. And, you know, people even race lawnmowers. And we've done that before.
I've seen it.
Carl, I'm going to pause you there just for a second, because I wanted to bring up a few things. First off, it's what I think is interesting about this collection is that it is not just Honda automobiles. It is not just Honda motorcycles, but as the photos were going, you can see Honda marine outboard motors and you can see Honda generators. And I swear, not in the images that we have, but from other images, that I'm fairly certain Honda lawnmowers are in this collection as well. But Smith and I, we are both aviation aficionados, and we were wondering, why isn't there a Honda jet in there?
Well, there's a model of a Honda jet.
There's a model. It's true. Yeah. But why isn't there a Honda jet in there?
Well, funnily enough, when I was dealing with our facilities executives and talking about things, and I thought, well, you know, why not think big? I mean, like massive big. And the main lobby that you would first come into is a couple of stories high. I mean, kind of really tall stories high. And there's a bridgeway that goes across. And I said, hey, why don't we hang a model of the Honda Jet over the main lobby? And they said, yeah, great idea, but no. So I mean, there's certain things that didn't come to pass, but you know, we do have a, so interesting, the American Honda Collection Hall is the second, actually it was technically the first, but it's the second now dedicated space for showcasing the history of our products in the US, because we have the Honda Heritage Center, which is in Marysville, Ohio, which is the hub of our manufacturing in the US. In fact, the first ever product that Honda built outside of Japan was the CR250R Elsinore motocross bike that we started building in Ohio in 1978. And the first automobile that was built outside of Japan was the Accord. And again, that was in Marysville, Ohio in 1982. So they
it's
do
only an have, hour up the road for me, Carl.
I've so been there. The Heritage Center does have a fuselage of the Honda Jet. So I'm still, you know, I'm still working. The you know, we're on a marathon. I this will remain here as far as I'm concerned through infinity and beyond. So. This is the first display, and I certainly would like to see if we can get something a little larger than the little model that we have that showcases the Honda Jet.
Well, if you want any help on that, I may have spent a few years working with the South Dakota Air and Space Museum, where when I left, they were getting ready to hang, I think, an L7 from the ceiling. Wow. Yeah, all kinds of stuff. That would be, that would just, oh, you have to convince them. And I know I'm an airplane nerd. You have to convince them. As great as all of these cars are, and that N600, that's probably either that, or I'm a big S2000 fan, if you can't tell behind me. Those two cars, oh, just mwah, chef's kiss. But walking into that lobby to be greeted by a Honda Jet swooping right down at you, we got to figure out how to make that happen.
Well, Chris, so, I'll tell the executives that you said that it should happen.
That's right. This weird guy with the anonymous name says that needs to happen.
So, Carl, we've got a double question from two of our commenters. And yes. So that's one of the fantastic things about this show. So we've got one question from a frequent commenter, Eric Nefron. He says, here's one for Carl. I was thinking about this yesterday. Is Honda's the largest producer of internal combustion engines in the world? And then another frequent commenter right after that, Group FBC, said, what a great question, Eric. I recall that being true between the engines, between automobiles, motorcycles, boats, power equipment, lawnmowers, generator, you know, between all of you guys. Is that a fair statement?
Yep, those guys are absolutely correct. So yes, Honda is the largest engine manufacturer in the world, because obviously, as you guys noted, you know, we have so many power equipment products. Mm-hmm. I mean, and those, in some cases, they're finished products, like the lawnmowers, like the snow blowers and the tillers. But also we make, you know, millions of utility engines that then other companies utilize to power their products as well. So indeed, that is true.
And I mean, lest we forget, 100 million of the Super Cubs. Am I correct on that?
Yep. So it's the probably will be the all-time highest quantity mobility product, because we're still making the Super Cub. So yes, over 100 million of those have been sold worldwide, and we continue to sell it to this day. We have a beautiful new one, the 125cc, that looks very, very vintage. I've seen them out and about, and we're still selling them. So that is entirely correct.
And I mean, Dad owns one. He does.
He does? I didn't know that, Bruce.
Yeah, he owns a Super Cub, and then he also owns a Navi, and then I own a Navi. So
okay,
we are one with the Honda motorbike system.
Okay, well, I mean, I know this is rambling about cars, but I mean, we cannot talk about Honda without talking about motorcycles a little bit, because that's how Honda rose to dominance, really, is through motorcycles. Do you know, Carl, about how many motorcycles are on display at the museum?
We have 70 products, roughly 70 products in total. It does change a little bit because I adjust the kind of main lobby display several times. So we have 30 cars and about 30 motorbikes, and then the rest of the items are either the power equipment, but we do have a couple of future kind of product as well, because when I spoke with Kaihara-san, our president of American Honda, he wanted to make sure that it wasn't just we dwelling on the past, but it represented our past, our present, and our future. And so we do have currently the first generation of the autonomous work vehicle.
We've seen that.
Basically, is ATV sized, and it has kind of a rack on the top that you can kind of fit with a bunch of different attachments, whatever they may be. But fully autonomous, it can kind of navigate challenging areas. But also, we have what we recently there you go, it's right there. And then on the other side, we don't have the current generation, because that was doing a proof of concept up in Canada at an airport to show how it could kind of be utilized in that sort of setting. But we have our autonomous lawnmower. So it's a ride-along lawnmower that has LiDAR and other sensors, including cameras, that enables it to navigate a park, a large garden, to be able to autonomously mow. But it's a commercial grade, so it's something that we're building for commercial usage rather than individual. So, yeah, so we have 30 motorcycles, going back to your original question.
How in the world, because I'm getting the sense that you really love this job and you love Honda, and it has our commenters are saying you're like the perfect guy for this. And with some of my museum experience, the South Dakota Air and Space Museum, it's with Ellsworth Air Force Base. On display, we probably had 10 times the things in storage that we wanted to display. How on earth can you make the decision of what to put out when there's so many amazing things to choose from?
Well, that's a whole nother story, because, as I said, we have 30 cars currently on display, but we have almost 80 in total. So not only did I have to build the museum, but we had to build some storage. So we have our R&D facility that's attached to our campus. And through negotiation and some arm twisting, I took over one of their buildings, completely knocked out all of the office area, and bought 25 vehicle lifts so I could kind of double up on the footprint. So then can have up to 60 vehicles in that space. So really, when I thought about how we'd want to open the collection hall, I thought, well, we really need to have the firsts and the most prominent. So in the Pico room, the image that you just saw, we have three of our first motorcycles. That was the Super Cub that you'd mentioned, the Dream, and the Bentley. So when we first started selling in America in 1959, it was those three models. And then we kind of have these two concentric horseshoes. So the middle, where you've seen images where you have that undulating ramp. So we go kind of through a timeline, starting from those very, very early, late 50s, early 60s bikes all the way around. And then you kind of do a U-turn, and then you come back, and then you start with actually the S600, which we didn't sell here in the US. There was a lot of gray markets that came over. There was one for sale just down the road, and we had to buy it. But then the N600 that you'd mentioned. So, yeah, we have really the first motorcycles, the first prominent bikes like the CB750, which really was the first superbike. It was the bike that really changed everything. The first with standard disc brakes, the first with electric start, overhead cams. Really, it kind of was the bike that destroyed the British motorcycle industry, because it outperformed every other bike, which were then considered the sport bikes of the era. Then we have the Elsinore, the first motocross bike that we produced, that ultimately dominated. We won our first championship on that bike. And again, that was the first product that we built in the US. And then, you know, the first Civic, the first Accord, the first Prelude, the first CRV, and, you know, the first Acura products, the Legend and the Integra, the first NSX. And then obviously we have some racing vehicles as well, just to kind of represent, you know, our racing footprint in the US.
And let me just do a quick shout out, because at the beginning you said that a lot of these cars you were able to get, but then some Honda had to go out and buy from owners. I personally would love to know, I mean, do you mention that on any of the displays? Because I would love to know which of the cars were purchased back from owners. I think that makes them even more special and worthy of being in the museum.
Yeah, well, we don't have any particular signage, but we do offer tours. So, you know, we've probably, I mean, it's amazing how the scope and scale of the collection hall completely blew up and exploded. And we're inundated requests with internal customers, exterior groups. So we do provide tours. So I personally do tours. We have a long-term Honda employee who's now retired. He's a wonderful docent. He has a lot of stories because he was around decades before I even started. And then we have a new hire, the first hire for someone who's solely dedicated to collection hall, because amazingly, it was always someone's side hustle. As I mentioned, you know, one of my primary roles is in public relations. So we do have three people that provide tours, but, you know, there's a couple of vehicles, one of which is not currently on display. And that is a 1,000,000 mile Accord. So there was a guy called Joe, who in New England, who felt as though he was a technician by trade. And he felt as though, you know, well-engineered vehicle, if you follow the maintenance schedule, if you treat it right, it will run indefinitely. And he got to 1,000,000 miles. And we kind of turned it into our first social media marketing outreach efforts with that vehicle. So we do have that in the collection. But as you see the images rotating, there's an interesting image where Chris Smith is your favorite S2000. Is actually a CR, and I'll tell you a story about that. But just a couple of vehicles down is a CRV, and it's the first generation, 1997. Yep. That's the one. And so that is probably the best and the worst vehicle in the collection for the same reason. So the best is that it is a beautiful example of a first generation 1997 CRV, and it has 250,000 miles on it. And I allow members of the media special permission to drive it. And so it's the worst in that, oh my goodness, how could you possibly have a car with 250,000 miles on it in a museum? Aren't they supposed to be all pristine? But it was a Honda associate that bought it new, raised his family in that car, drove to and from work for decades. And then when he decided to upgrade it, he offered it up to the museum, and it was in such beautiful shape because he maintained it wonderfully, kept it clean, kept it garaged, and it's in fantastic condition. And little did we know in 1997 that this kind of niche market of a unibody SUV would ultimately become Honda's best-selling model, where we've been selling over 350,000 retail units a year. So it's really iconic in that really it's now the best-selling vehicle. It's the first of that, but also it has this wonderful story that it was a Honda associate who put 250,000 miles on it. And kind of moving along to kind of interesting stories, that beautiful 2009 S2000 CR, which is quite the unicorn. I mean, the white one as popular as the blue and the yellow and the black and the red. But that was an internal barn find. So I get a call after I'd taken over the collection hall before we moved into the new facility. And it was the president of our, the vice president of our facilities, and said, "Hey, Carl, we've got this car. We found it in a Texas training center. And, you know, we think you might be interested in it." So I said, "Well, what is it?" They said, "Oh, it's an S2000. Obviously, my interest was piqued. And they said, "Well, it's a CR." And it was piqued even further. And then they said, "Yeah, and it only has less than 300 miles on it." And it just blew my mind. So I'm like, "I'm having it. Give it to me." So we had it brought out to Torrance. And it was the scariest thing in the world for me to start that car up. And I this was when we were still off campus at the warehouse. And I had to drive it, which was probably the most expensive vehicle that we had because of how few miles. And just recently, before I got it in my hands, a similarly mild, similar year S2000 sold for $200,000 on Bringer Trailer.
Thanks so much, Carl. I literally have that link pulled up right now. I was thinking about that as we were talking about it. Yes. A 123-mile S2000 CR, $200,000 on Bring a Trailer.
Yeah. So, you know, it has a little bit more miles than that, but it has ours as about 270. But still, I mean, I opened the door and just that whiff of new car smell hit me. I opened up the hood and I literally could have eaten my dinner off the engine. It was so clean. Oh. And, you know, it's drivable. So, so it's there for people to enjoy. And it's absolutely gorgeous. So it's interesting that between that Insight, the first generation Insight that you saw between, you have bookended. We have the 250,000-mile CRV. And then we have that the ultimate, perhaps ultimate, a Honda enthusiast car, that S2000 CR.
What a great dichotomy. The only thing missing there is a big, nice big V6 outboard.
So, Carl, I know we don't have that much time left with you, but I want to leave it with a question from the audience. You get to drive the Pacific Coast Highway. What are you going to pick? An NSX, an S2000, or an SBR 650?
Oh boy. Each of them in their own way. But you know what? That S2000, if it's the CR, you have to take the top off. If it's a standard one, you drop the top down. But something about the wind in your hair, that rear wheel drive, and just, you know, the very kind of tactile analog experience of driving that car. But you know what? I wouldn't drive it on PCH. I'd go to Angeles Crest Highway, hit the canyon, hit the mountain. Okay. That's where that car really shines, as does the NSX, to be, you know, obviously. But yeah, they just manually shifting. I mean, the first generation NSX as well, you know, manual shift. That's where it's at. So yeah, I would probably choose, especially if I was going PCH, you know, dropping that top down, getting some sun, get some, ocean breeze through my nostrils and through my hair. I do have hair, even though I'm wearing a hat. I've got some terrible hair right now.
I got a hat on too, man. There's nothing wrong with that.
So, people have asked me, you know, what is my favorite car in the collection? And it's so hard to make a decision.
Of course it is.
I vacillate between the N600 because it was a motorcycle company that built a car. It was a 600cc twin cylinder. And interestingly, it sold for about $1,300 and it weighed 1,300 pounds. So it was a dollar a pound. I don't know what you can get for a dollar a pound now, but it's certainly not a car. First generation CRV, just because now it's really what built the company's success that we enjoy now. But then the ultimate enthusiast car for me, that S2000 CR.
Okay.
Oh, well, very fantastic good. Museum. If you have the chance, everybody, get out there on one of their cars and bikes and coffee events. We'll have a link here in the video where you can go and see, check out information on the museum. Carl, before we let you go, and honestly, I could talk with you for like the next 2 hours.
But I want you to come back sometime.
Appreciate your time. Anything you want to shout out here before you head out for the day?
Yeah, just hondacollectionhall.com is the URL for our website. So you can go there and get information about it. But yeah, please, if you're in Southern California, please come out, whatever you have. Doesn't have to be a Honda, doesn't have to be an Acura. We love to get the whole Southern California auto and motorcycle community out to enjoy spending time together, kicking the tires, slamming the hood, checking out what's under the hood. So please come out. I really want to make it a must-go-to event for Southern California enthusiasts. So I really appreciate you guys, Chris and Chris. This is a wonderful opportunity. And I could talk all night too, but I'm sure people want to learn about other stuff. So thanks very much for the opportunity.
Well, thanks for being with us. That was really great. Thank you.
You're welcome.
All right. Very good. All right, Smith. Well, that was fantastic. I really want to have Carl back sometime. I would love to talk more Honda stuff with him.
So many questions.
Whether it's, you know,
it's time for me to either get rid of the Mustang in the show and get the S2000 like I should have done several years ago when I had the chance, or just go ahead, keep those things, get the 750 Nighthawk that I've wanted for decades. Because I'm not really a motorcycle guy, but I've always loved the 750 Nighthawk. Like a nice, like mid or late 80s. Mm.
I mean, between our pals, Yannicky and Jason, I think they could hook you up pretty
easily. Oh, I'm sure. And then they're still, I mean, they're relatively affordable too. S2000s have, oh man, if I had bought the S2000 instead of the 03 Cobra that I got, when was that?
You would have doubled your money.
About 11 years ago. Because I was shopping in like that 15 to 20 grand range. And I found the Cobra first, and I should have stuck to my guns because I kind of wanted the S2000, but I found the Cobra and it had some mods and V8. If I'd have had the S2000, well, I mean, the Cobras have gone up too. I don't see any of them selling for 200 grand though. You know what I'm saying?
I know.
Thank you so much, Carl. And yeah. If for those who aren't catching us live, our audio fans, we still love you. Spotify, Apple, iHeartRadio, Amazon, Deezer, so many platforms. If you have any questions that you would like us to try to track down with Carl, email podcast@mortal1.com. We're happy. Yeah. Trust me. We're happy to talk to Carl some more. I want to thank our commenters here live that were tossing us some questions and some comments. I agree. He sounds like he is like the perfect person for that job. He doesn't just know Honda. He's passionate about all aspects that comes through. Super happy to have him on board. I kind of don't want to talk about anything else, Bruce.
But we got to.
How do we top that? I mean,
we're only 38 minutes into the show. We gotta give the people the content. Need the content.
You can talk about a 670 horsepower Porsche Panamera turbo, I guess, but
okay.
Can we talk about the N600 a little bit more? That was kind of my choice for Pacific Coast. That or S2000, and I didn't get a chance to say anything about the beautiful blue 99 Civic Si that was sitting in that collection. I'll be honest. Through the 90s, I just started college, mid-90s, and the Honda scene was starting to pick up a little bit. And I didn't really pay attention until I saw and heard and drove a 99 Civic Si. And
you want to hear my creepy, well, not creepy, but my nostalgic version of that, which is back in the day, Speed Vision. For anyone who remembers Speed Vision.
Yep.
They used to show like IMSA racing and real time racing. They had their Integra Type R's, and those things were dominant in that class.
Yep.
They just ate everyone else's lunch. And that's, you know.
The ITRs were neat. I was never really sold on their styling. I thought that 99 Civic Si looked really great with a nice exhaust. Well, even just in stock mode, it sounded fine. But like a nice proper exhaust, not just say, I'm going to take a hex on, cut the muffler off. That sounds terrible. But a nice tuned exhaust, I mean, just listening to that engine just sing up into the rev range. Oof, yeah. We definitely need to have him back.
Nostalgia but for a little bit.
We got to talk about this damn 670 horsepower Porsche. So there's my wonderful segue, debuting earlier this week, was it late last week?
It was
over our Thanksgiving holiday. That's what was confusing me there. So yeah. Next generation, the new Porsche Panamera. Tell us about it, Bruce. Not new,
refreshed.
Well,
do you want me to handle this? They're calling it
the third generation, but yeah, I mean, it's a big refresh, right?
It's somewhere between a major refresh and a new generation. I think it's more of a refresh, but
it's when you look at it, it's like, okay, that's a new generation. It looks like a Panamera, but I mean, there are some styling changes. I mean, they've got that new weird kind of looking Knight Rider intake up front. Sure. That's the first thing I thought about, Bruce, when I saw the front of this car, because you have it's for our audio listeners. The front fascia, it still looks much like a Panamera. It's got new matrix LED snazzy headlights, but there's that long black horizontal strip that now sits right above the bumper. It's for extra airflow.
Sure.
I mean, I kind of like it, but I mean, can you imagine a little red LED going back and forth in there?
The more you talk about it, the more I can imagine it being there. When you first said it, I thought you're crazy. And now, you imagine things and yeah, I guess.
Yep. You're going to be seeing it in your mind now, but yeah, I mean, it has those new headlights up front. It's a neat refresh. I mean, if we want to call it a refresh or a new generation, Porsche is calling it a new generation. I think it looks a little more aggressive. I think it's certainly an improvement from the outgoing model. And there's some new stuff on the inside as well. There's a lot of familiarity, but we're seeing a little bit more Taycan on the interior. There's an updated center console. Guess what? You can get a passenger touchscreen now. It's an option for the new Panamera. You probably want to hear about the 670 horsepower thing that we've been talking about. That's going to be the new turbo e-hybrid. That's the 4-liter twin turbo V8 with a single electric motor tucked into the 8-speed transmission. There's a 25.9 kilowatt hour battery. And yes, the combined output there is 670 horsepower. And Porsche says it'll do 0 to 60 in 3.0 seconds, top speed of 195 miles an hour. If you don't want to go that fast, you can jump into the standard Panamera. It's not a hybrid. It's got the 2.9-liter turbo V6 with 348 horsepower, 368 pound-feet of torque. That'll still do 60 in 5 seconds. For a base car, we're so jaded now. Zero to 60 5 seconds is fast. And this is base Panamera. Rear-wheel drive, not all-wheel drive.
Waiting for me to reply that. So our headline calls out the wild rear suspension, and that is because you get a two-chamber, two-valve air suspension. That's the standard tech. However, if you want to upgrade, and this is on the e-hybrid model, you get a system that can control both pitch and roll and a rear axle steering system, which is an additional option. So basically, all sorts of rear suspension tech. Mm-hmm. Hopefully it never goes wrong.
We should point out to that because this is kind of a big deal, I think. It's the Porsche Active Ride. We actually had a go in a prototype, and you can read the article over motor1.com. We'll get the link in the video description. And it's sort of eerie the way this suspension kind of dials in. It senses the road in front of you. It can see things. It can make adjustments ahead of time if it detects there might be some puddles or things. And it can kind of balance out your left and right body roll a little bit. We've seen that in other cars. But this goes Mercedes, a little further.
Yeah.
Yep. This goes a little further in that it detects when you're stabbing the gas or when you're standing on the brakes. And it will lift the front or the rear accordingly to offset that. So I think it was alluded to in our article when you're stopping. If you've ever been, if you're a skateboarder and you have some experience and you go flying off the skateboard where your feet just kind of go out in front of you, it sort of feels like that when it's stopping. I thought that was a really great description of that because you're standing on the brakes, you're expecting the car to nose down and go forward, and it just kind of doesn't. It stays there. You stab the gas, you expect the front to lift up a little bit. It doesn't. It just goes. I'm very, very interested in driving this to experience that. I want to see.
Agreed.
It's sort of maybe an interesting take on that. I want to see if it takes away anything from the driving experience. If it maybe desensitizes a little bit, because you're so used to stabbing the brakes. I mean, even in a really strongly tuned performance car, you're going to feel just a little bit of drop. And I mean, that's sensory feedback. I'm wondering if there's any desensitization going on here. Is that a word? Desensitization? I'm making it. It's a word.
Desensitizing?
Desensitizing?
I think that's the word.
Could be. Desensitization. I kind of like that too. I don't know if it exists. I'm making it up. I'm a writer.
Desensitization it is.
I can make it up. It's a really trick system. I really want to experience it. And Porsche kind of made a big deal about that. Rightfully so. We can tell you that the new Panamera starts at a base price, $101,550. That's for the rear-wheel drive model with the V6. The all-wheel drive starts at $108,550. We know, Porsche, there will be four various e-hybrid models, but we only have information for the turbo e-hybrid at this time. We don't have any pricing on that either. The Not turbo the pricing will come. Nope. Yeah. The turbo later. Pricing will come later on. But yeah, I'm a little surprised that Porsche debuted over a holiday weekend in the U.S. But I think it's a step in the right direction for the Panamera.
But so Smith, you know this, where the company's headquarters are often determine when things happen much more when their most important markets are. Porsche is headquartered in Germany. It wouldn't shock me that someone in Germany made this decision, because Thanksgiving is an American holiday. We are not a monoculture. Like, it is not just America and then there's the rest of the world. Like,
right. But if I was planning a very notable product launch, I would at least check things to make sure, okay, what's going on in our major markets? Are we going to like in my comms and PR days? I never, never, never put out press releases on Mondays or Fridays, because Fridays, people just want to get the hell home. They don't care. Mondays, people are miserable. They're going to be that they're back. They don't care. So Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, and you're always checking for holidays. So Porsche, if you need some help on the comms department, let me know. I'm saying this because
Smith, make sure you bring me with you, okay, man? Like, don't leave me hanging here.
I'm saying this because I'm a little sad. I feel like Porsche could have maybe had a little more traction, and I want them to have a little more traction because this suspension setup sounds amazing. 670 horsepower is amazing too. We're so jaded with power that's kind of not that big of a deal to me. I want to see what the suspension system's like. I want to experience that. And I feel like maybe it slipped under the radar a little bit. And frankly, a major American market.
I want to have a quick conversation with you. And that is the fact that the Sport Turismo Panamera is dead.
Yeah.
Apparently, according to Porsche, it was less than 10% of demand for the model. And it doesn't so much bother me that it's dead, whatever. Of course, automakers have to make decisions based on what they're selling. Do you think in the future, the existing Sport Turismos that are out there become a collector's item?
Oh, hell yes.
Something that enthusiasts are looking for?
Hell yes. Because here's the thing when it comes to wagons, and that's what this is. Okay. I understand the marketing spin. It's the Sport Turismo.
This is a wagon. It's the wagonest wagon that ever wagoned.
It's a wagon. And if I were to buy a Panamera, that's the one I would get because I think it looks even better. It has a little more practicality. It has a little more capability and it's just as fast. And I think it's just a mean looking wagon. But the reality is there aren't many people interested in such things. If they're going to get a wagon, they would rather have an SUV and that's fine. But what that means on the other side of this, those of us who want this vehicle, we really want it. So we will pay for it.
Premium that, what you just said, that if you want this type of vehicle, you're going to pay for it. And this, and now it's less than 10% of the cars that are out there.
Mm-hmm.
There are not many of them. So if you want it, you're going to have to pay.
Take a look at the Cadillac CTS-V wagons that are out there. Take a look, and here's a shocker, because I figured, okay, I'll slip in under the Buick radar here. I'll wait 3 or 4 years or so after they discontinued the Regal Tour X. And Bruce, you drove a Regal Tour X.
Yeah,
it's
fantastic.
It's a neat car. It has good performance, lots of practicality.
Fantastic's a strong word. It was a very good car.
Well, guess what? Those prices haven't come down like I thought they would.
Really?
Really? They're, I mean, you don't have to get like a third mortgage on your house, but they're not falling like I thought they would. Because I figured, I'll slip in. I'll buy one. I'll buy one 3 or 4 years used. Maybe I can slip in for around 10 or 15 grand because it's going to be, it's a Buick Regal. Nobody wants these things, right? Well,
exactly.
Mainstream didn't want them, but the buyers interested really, really want them. So they're snapped up.
I drove a loaded example and just like fully loaded. And it had, adaptive cruise control, lane assist, just basically all the stuff you would expect from a car today, mm-hmm. from a car, 3 to 4 years ago. It was fine. Like,
yep.
It's not a sports car. It's not like, oh, I'm going to take it to the track. But
it's got decent performance and it's comfortable and it has a lot of practicality.
Yes.
I mean, this is when I was thinking of, okay, Mazda 6 replacement. What am I going to do?
Yeah. No. We have two different opinions about the Panamera Sport Turismo in our comments. It's a budget Ferrari FF. That's fair, especially if you go to the top end Sport Turismo. That's very fair. But then Grupa FBC says it won't be an appreciating classic, but it will depreciate slower. I don't know.
That's accurate. I mean, it will depreciate. It's not going to be like, in 10 years you can go buy one for 10 or 15 grand. That's never going to happen. And frankly, we see that a lot with a lot of mass-produced, volume Porsche products.
Sure.
I could go
still shopping for a first-gen Cayman and can't find one in my price range. So
yeah, but you know what?
On what you consider.
I bet you could find a pretty decent first-gen Panamera for 10 or 15 grand.
You think? I don't think so.
I'll be honest. I haven't checked. I don't know what the pricing is, but I would be willing to bet because it kind of lumps into me with the Cayenne a little bit. And I know you can find first and second gen Cayenne SUVs for 10, 15 grand.
Yes, you
can. And the first gen Panamera, everybody thought was ugly. And I mean, I didn't think it was, it looked a little awkward, but I didn't think it was that ugly. But they're fantastic vehicles to drive.
Right.
The Sport Turismo will never get. You're not supposed to say never. I'm saying never. Never going to get there.
Yeah.
Never going to fall that far down.
No. It's always going to be worth more than the sedan version just because it's so much rarer. Mm-hmm. And there's always going to be someone. There's going to be someone out there like, oh, I don't want the I want something a little bit different. Yeah.
Yep. Yeah. And cool. I mean, when we see it happening with Buick, I mean, come on, it's Buick, like the AARP vehicle of choice. You know, it's not going to happen for Porsche. It's not going to go that way for Porsche. So
we saw from our commenters earlier, they are not in love with this topic, but it is something we want to talk about.
We've got a brush on it here because it's a big deal, like it or not.
It's a big deal, guys. Just like put your fingers in your ears for a few minutes and then we'll, oh, thanks a lot, Eric Nephron. I'm off, gents. Good night. Come on. We've got another topic after this.
You got to stick around. We might have something that you don't know about here.
We're going to talk about a short wheelbase Land Cruiser and a transparent engine. We've got other stuff, but we've got to appeal to like the people that are going to listen to the show. Oh my God. Our watchers have fallen down to four people. Smith, maybe we shouldn't talk about this.
Let's be quick here. We have like four people left. We can do this. We can bring this back.
Bro, my parents.
So the Cybertruck, it debuted in 2019 in concept form.
Yes.
And we were told all of these things. And to be fair to Tesla, much has happened since 2019, the least of which being a global pandemic, supply chain shortages resulting from that pandemic, and many other a lot has happened. It's been delayed. But it finally, I don't know that we call it a debut because this is the ceremony showing, hey, we have these in production and now we're going to deliver some of them.
Okay. For anyone out there who doesn't know, for any of our listeners who don't know, allegedly they are going to deliver 10, the number of fingers on my hand, to customers. All of those customers work for Tesla. They will have 25 Cybertrucks there. The other 15 will be either for, you know, journalists to take pictures of. They'll be for test rides. They'll be for stuff like that. Mm-hmm. So total of 25 vehicles, 10 for customers. But I guess that counts as it being in production.
Yeah, this will be the production version. They're going to owners.
They're going to deliver them to 10 people.
Yeah. So this is going to be the version that people that have reservations in place will get. I mean, we're saying all of this because Tesla doesn't operate like any other automaker. There is no PR department. There is no real marketing group.
Email Tesla's PR department, you get a poop emoji back. That is not a lie.
So, I mean, we just have to go with what is presented at public events like this. I mean, and we do know, okay, the Cybertruck looks more or less like it did in concept form. It has regular size mirrors on it now. That's some changes to the lights. Bruce, you did a really good write-up on it, just everything that we know today. The charging port is tucked into the fender lip, which I think is actually kind of neat. Instead of having this just a big door on the side, it's kind of tucked in there. We know, okay, the interior is kind of it's got more or less a standard-ish Tesla interior with just the
it's very Tesla. It's got a frunk. It's got a small-ish frunk. If you look at it in photos, it looks like it's enough for like a soft overnight bag. It's enough for, you know, several bags of groceries, certainly, but it's not big by anyone's.
And feel free to send me the hate mail. You can send it, you know what, chris.smith@motorone.com. you don't even need to go through podcasts. You can send it right to me,
bruce@motorone.com. bring it to me, guys.
I am a very firm believer in, okay, if we are going to have electric vehicles with electric powertrains, let's design something that makes the most of that powertrain instead of trying to make it look like old vehicles with space for big engines and transmissions and all this. I still don't know. I know a lot of people love to make fun of the Cybertruck's design. It is polarizing. It is very just full of triangles, but it's at least designed to make the most of an electric powertrain. And I feel the same way about, I feel the same way about Mercedes and their EQS vehicles. Let's create a design that makes the most of this new powertrain instead of trying to make it fit in the old definition, if you will. I feel like there's a compromise there if you're doing that. And the Cybertruck, obviously, there's no big engine in the front, so we don't need no big stinking hood with a big frunk up front. There's a big bed in the back.
Have you looked at the images of the amount of room between the dashboard and the windshield? Like, it's literally, and I'm not making a joke here. You could sleep a toddler in there. It's big. It's a small bed.
Bruce, have you ever driven one of GM's Dustbusters from the late 80s and early 90s?
I have not been in one.
And by Dustbuster, for those who don't know, I'm talking about like the Chevy Lumina APV. What else was there? The Pontiac
Oldsmobile Silhouette and the Pontiac Trans Sport.
Yes. In fact, I've even seen some memes like, hey, the predecessor to the Cybertruck was the Lumina APV with that big raked windshield. I'm not going to get on the hype train of junking
personally,
that.
I was in a Pontiac Transport, but yes.
It's a steeply raked windshield. If you want to clean it, you know what? They make all kinds of little tools. I was a detailer for many years. They make all kinds of little tools that you can just reach down in there to clean the windshield. I'm not going to jump on that hype train. It's extremely raked, and I want to see just how functional that windshield wiper is. But I'll give it the benefit of the doubt once we actually see what the production version is all about. Because right now we're just looking at a near production version in photos.
Right. We are. Again, I wrote about this vehicle. I spent about 5 hours this morning writing about this vehicle today. There are certainly interesting facts about it, and I'm going to share some of those with our folks tonight. I understand we're running kind of sort of out of time, but in terms of specs, it's really, really interesting because I don't know yet where to put this vehicle in terms of the pickup truck sphere. It's roughly sized with a full-size pickup. Your Ford F-150, your Silverado, your Ram F-1500, stuff like that. But if you look at the weight of them, or if you look at the weight of it, it's kind of closer to the kind of the HD counterparts, yep. Super Duty, the Ram 2500, the Silverado 2500. And so you get into kind of this weird thing. And so it can tow 11,000 pounds. That is more than an F-150 Lightning, the electric vehicle. That is more than a GMC EV. However, it is less than a current F-150. It's less than a current Chevy Silverado.
And it's way less than the HD versions. Right.
And it's way, way less. It's, yep. Yeah. It has a 2,500 pound payload that beats everything else on the market, unless you start considering those HD trucks, and then it pales in comparison. So it, you know, it beats the EV trucks, it beats the full size trucks, your F-150, Silverado, etc. But if you were going to buy a Super Duty or a Silverado HD or a Ram HD, whatever, they're going to be able to haul more in their bed than a Cybertruck can. And
to be fair, yes, we are comparing vehicles that probably aren't going to be compared. But we're looking at this from just a sheer size. We're looking at this from a sheer size and weight standpoint. And when you take that into consideration, I mean, yes, this combustion wise, this stacks up, I think, closer to an HD vehicle when you're talking about just the size and its weight versus half tons.
We have the photos, and I'm not going to pull them up here because I'm talking for a second, but we have the photos that you cannot put a regular, just, you know, a regular bicycle in the back of this without hanging the front wheels over the tailgate. Whereas F-150, Super Duty, you know, vehicles like that. Hell, I've got a Subaru Outback. I've literally carried a bike in the back of that. Mm-hmm. It's not the greatest thing, and you know, it's like all whopper jawed, but
And this is where I'll share the comment from Group FBC. It's actually a massively compromised vehicle in terms of packaging and space, all for the geometric styling. I will agree with you there. I think at least in terms of passenger space, I still haven't seen yet what it's like in that backseat, but I can't imagine that crazy sloped roof as offering gobs of headroom, or at least a sense of airiness in a vehicle that's that large. And we have seen where some of the cargo capability is compromised. I will agree with you there. I still think it was designed with the idea of an electric powertrain in mind, but they then kind of went, let's just make this weird. And I think you will lose a little bit in there. I will agree with you on that one.
Well, here's this is from our colleagues at Inside EVs, and this kind of perfectly, this is perfect. So you can see on both a Rivian R1T, admittedly, and a Cybertruck, you could not put a regular bicycle in the back of them. I know, because I've done it in my Subaru Outback, I can put a bicycle in the back. Or, you know, and the other thing is that you can obviously buy hitch hookups, and you could put, you know, bike mm-hmm. hookups on there, and that's a completely different thing. But when I look at this image with the Tesla with the bike in the back, you see the rear window. It's really compromising your rearward visibility, significantly less so than what you're getting in the Rivian.
Right.
And, you know, I just don't know. It's a really weird thing to consider.
This is another vehicle that I'm really curious to drive to see if all of these things that we are mentioning here, and to be frank, a lot of other people are talking about, are actually correct. Because yeah, when you look at this, you think, oh, there's not much rearward visibility. But then again, you go buy a cargo van that's a work van that has zero visibility. Right. That's what you have the side mirrors for. And, you know, there are going to be cameras back there that give you a look behind. And to be fair, also to Cybertruck, there are many quad cab full size pickup trucks with the shorter bed that still won't fit a bicycle like this. It's not just an electric thing.
That's true.
If you go get a full quad cab Ford or a full quad cab Ram, those generally have five or five and a half bed. That's still a pretty short bed.
Yes.
Lots of issues there. But yeah, more to come on Cybertruck. This event takes place tomorrow.
Yep.
So we're just kind of priming you for that. Check MotorOne.com for everything there. You also check InsideEVs.com, our colleagues over there. Admittedly, they're going to have a lot more coverage, and rightfully so, because this is right up their alley. Well, we'll have some good takes on it for you as well at Motor One. But definitely, hey, stay tuned for this. If nothing else, to see, is there going to be some big surprise? You know, love or hate Elon Musk, he tends to pull something out of a hat at these events. So,
well, you never know. There's going to be a beast mode, and allegedly the Cybertruck's going to be able to reach 60 miles per hour in less than 3 seconds. And if that's the case, it's going to be possibly the fastest consumer, you know, production pickup truck ever. Like yeah. That's something.
Well, we'll have to wait and see. We'll have to wait and see, and hopefully more info is coming tomorrow.
Yes, tomorrow afternoon. It's an interesting vehicle, and we've waited for it for so long, and we've speculated about it for so long that to finally have it and to think about it is, yeah, it's a lot.
So more to come, but right now we're running a little long on time, Bruce. How about we jump into Land Cruiser? From a vehicle that there's very strong opinions about, to something that is this universally loved? We're talking about the Land Cruiser 70, which has been in production since 1984, I think.
I believe you're right.
Now, I mean, there have been some facelifts over the years, but this isn't a new generation. This is the Land Cruiser 70. And in particular, this one going on sale in the UAE is the Shorty three-door. So you got the two doors on the side and then the one in the back. That's a 91-inch wheelbase. It's shorter than a Wrangler.
It is. It's, technically, they call this the 71 series. They're all 70 series, but like, you know, the various version of the 70. This is the 71 series, technically. And yeah, this is the three-door, short wheelbase Land Cruiser. And damn it, I don't love it.
It's short. And I mean, that's what you want in an off-roader. For many years, I've complained, and not often on Rambling here, but I've complained that when Jeep came out with their Wrangler Unlimited, it's just like, oh, that's just that's such a ridiculous concept. You already have the Cherokee, just stick with that. But I mean, people wanted the Wrangler styling, but they wanted it in a bigger vehicle, and it killed, in my mind, everything that the Wrangler and previous Jeeps of that nature stood for. That short wheelbase, easily maneuverable off-road, and this Land Cruiser just clicks all of those happy buttons for me. I would not want to drive it over 50 miles an hour around any corner whatsoever. But I mean, it's an old design, but hey, it's got LED headlights. There's a 9-inch infotainment screen. It has some driver assists. It's got pre-collision system, lane departure alert.
It's got a tire pressure monitoring system. It's got daytime running light. It's got basically the most basic amenities you would expect from a vehicle today in something that is, I mean, you kind of feel like it's going to last through the apocalypse. The engine, it's a naturally aspirated 4-liter four-liter naturally aspirated V6, making 228 horsepower, 266 pound-feet of torque. You got a five-speed manual gearbox, or six-speed manual gearbox,
six-speed. You can't buy it in the U.S., obviously, but if you could, the price would be equivalent to about $46,000. But that's tough to go by because, I mean, different markets, the way things are built, the various fees that are built in, It's tough to make that translation. And Bruce, I think you froze up on me, so I'm going to keep talking until you come back to life here.
I totally did.
you're like, I can hear you, but you totally froze up on the screen.
Okay, yeah, I am frozen on my computer as well. I don't know what happened. You can still hear me?
I can still hear you just fine, but you have on the video, you just have this kind of goofy looking look on your face. So, okay. that's all right. Keep talking here. I mean, that's about all we got for Land Cruiser 70 series. Yeah. We wanted to talk about it because it was kind of a surprising hit for our Motor One audience. And whenever we see something like that, we want to make sure we share it with all the Rambling crew out there as well. Bruce, do you want me to handle the see-through engine?
You're kind of going to have to because I'm on a Mac and I've got the bouncing ball of death or the beach ball of death, however you want to call it. I'm trying to get my stuff back here, but it's not going well.
Well, don't you worry. Don't you worry none, because I'm going to bring up this transparent engine. This is something that we also posted over the long holiday here for the United States. And it's just as it sounds, right? It's a see-through V8 engine, but it's life-size, and it's based on an LS V8. Now, you're not going to swap this into any car, because to make it see-through, I mean, it's plexiglass. It's thick plexiglass. And it's not designed to actually run. And by that, I mean running on fuel. But there is an electric motor hooked up to it. And there is, I don't know if we have a, we don't have a gallery set up here for this one. There is an oil tank at the bottom, a regular oil pan filled with oil. So you flip on the electric motor and you watch it go around. And there's cool little lights put into the cylinders. And it actually spins pretty quick here. Let me see if I can get this video cranking up here just a little bit. I'm not quite as used to running all the show as Bruce is. So just kind of bear with me a moment here as we get up to speed on this engine. Let me jump up here a little bit. There, we're seeing it a little bit here on the inside. I mean, it's got the push rods plugged in there. There you can see all the lights firing. It doesn't spin slowly. It doesn't spin slowly at all. It actually clicks along pretty good. And I think it's just a fascinating take on seeing a combustion engine in operation without actual combustion.
Folks, real quick, am I back? Can you see me? Smith, can you see me? Are we good now?
Unfortunately, yes. No, you're back, buddy.
Okay. Sorry, I don't know what happened there.
You're back. You recovered. You survive. Yep. You survive the boot apocalypse.
I guess so.
We've had a lot of engine content. We actually talked about having another engine discussion. I know, Bruce, you wrote up a piece on another catastrophic engine explosion, but it's like,
yeah, it was a BMW N26. It just wasn't quite as catastrophic enough to be worth considering. Whereas this one, this guy did a really, really interesting job because
that light show is just mesmerizing, isn't it?
Well, right. But it also illustrates something really, really important where you can see the way that the cylinders fire one side to the other, one side to the other, and they go across each cylinder at the same time. And it's fascinating because, as you can see there, if you're watching along, it's driven by just a hand drill. Like, he's got that hooked up to the crankshaft, and that's running, and that's enough to run all of the bits and pieces, the cylinders, the valves, the fake spark plugs, everything.
Yeah, I mean, it reminds me of the engines that you can build it, in like model kit form, where you can hook up some LED lights, see them work. This is full size, and when you turn the lights out and just, I mean, it's a choreographed mechanical ballet. And am I being too cheesy by saying that? It's a mechanical choreographed ballet.
Because I think something that we forget a lot of times when we're talking about cars is just how mechanically complex they are. And when you look at this engine, it actually is, by the standards of the modern internal combustion engine, it's not that complex at all. It's a cam in block engine. There are rocker arms that are working on the rockers that are working on the cams and, stuff like that. It's not that complex, but once you see all of those pieces working together, even though this is 50, 60 year old technology, it's really impressive. And then you just consider how far things have progressed today, and kind of we are, Smith, I don't feel like I'm being overly dramatic saying this, we're at the last gasp of the internal combustion engine. We have essentially developed it as far as it's going to go, and in the future, we've seen, obviously, electric motors seem to be the future. We've seen companies like Toyota work on hydrogen combustion engines, where it's not a hydrogen fuel cell, it's literally hydrogen combustion, where rather than using gasoline, they're using hydrogen. We've kind of developed this tech over the course of a century and some change to get to where we are today, and kind of maybe that technology has reached its peak.
I think overall, yes. I think there will still be some development just to make things a little more efficient, to try to balance that efficiency with horsepower. We're not going to see some revolutionary new combustion design. We're not going to see like a camless engine where everything is just electronic and and push. But I don't think we're ever going to see anything like that. I know there, if I remember correctly, there've been some test engines and maybe even some race engines developed like that, but nothing like that for street use. We're not going to see that kind of development going forward. And honestly, I get a little bent out of shape when I hear people say, a double overhead cam engine is so much more sophisticated and superior to like a cam in block pushrod engine. That's an old dinosaur. It's like, dude, they were making double overhead cam sophisticated engines in the 20s. It's not like it's brand new technology. And
I mean,
it's considerably more complex and it creates a much larger engine. And I love double overhead cam as much as anybody else. They have some great attributes, but so do some of these cam and block designs. And I have to salute GM for their LS. That is a honed product that can serve so many applications.
50, 60 years. Cause it's essentially a very slow evolution of the Chevy's small block. They, 55 is the first small block Chevy, I believe, 55 model year. And they've just been evolving that over time and over time and over time and improving it.
And it's a simpler design. It's a more compact design. It fits into places where you wouldn't be able to shove a big old double overhead cam in there, and it works. So that's all I'm going to say on that.
Yeah.
What else we got, Bruce?
That's our kind of everything we had for tonight. I'm sorry that I missed for 4 or 5 minutes or so because my internet decided to crap out.
We've been doing this long enough. It's just like, just keep going. We got this, man. I do want to shout out Ted Adam Green before we go. I do want to shout out Ted Adam Green. You sent in a great email that we don't have time today, but we're going to get to it next week. A great email on a road trip. And we want to see more of those. So Ramblers, wherever you're at, if you're catching us, Motor One.com Facebook, Motor One.com Twitter, Motor One YouTube. If you're catching us audio on Spotify, Apple, Deezer, iHeartRadio, all the stuff that I know I've already mentioned, send us email podcast@motorone.com. Tell us about a recent road trip like Ted Adam Green did. It's a great story. I can't wait to share it with everybody. Thank you for sending that in. But aside from that, Bruce, I think it's time to take us home, buddy.
Yep. Real quick, I will say Groupa FBC, there's a reason LS swap is a thing in this world. Yeah,
yeah,
there's a reason. It's because it's like you're
saying. It's good. It's reliable. It's powerful.
It's it does everything.
Parts are cheap. Yeah.
Yeah. It does all of that. But yeah, thank you, everybody. I think definitely because it's November 29th. So Carl will be the last guest for this month. We do have a guest set up for December 13th. I won't say who that is because I've had this issue before where we say we're going to have guests and things fall through. So we're probably going to have a guest for December 13th. So next week you'll have Smith and I, and we'll be talking about cars and car news. We'll probably be talking about whatever comes out of the Cybertruck thing. Maybe there'll be surprises. We don't know.
If there are no Group surprises, FBC, you got to tune in for that one.
Yeah. But yeah, so that'll be for us. But otherwise, I think that's the show for tonight. As Smith said, Ted Adam Green, thank you so much for that email. We both read it. It's a fantastic thing. We just kind of ran out of time for tonight because we try to keep the show sub an hour 30, and we're kind of kissing that right now. So we'll get you next week, but we both read it. It's a great email. So thank you very much there. But with that, I think that's all. So good morning, good afternoon, good evening, or good night. We appreciate all the time that you guys decide to spend with us. We just appreciate every listener, every comment, every email, and anything that you guys do with us. We appreciate it and we love it. And I think that'll be the show. So good night, everybody. And we will see you next Wednesday. So bye-bye.
Bye, everybody.